All right, and actually, quite a few of the things I'm going to say have already been said, so we can make it shorter. The two points I'm going to address are the X-ray luminosity function. One is population studies of sources, X-ray binaries in star-forming galaxies, and here in the background is an example of a very highly star-forming galaxy, the Antennae galaxies seen by Chandra. And then I will say something about ultraluminous X-ray sources, of which, in fact, there is quite a number in this galaxy. As already been said, go very quick. I think we need to go to external galaxies. I think we all agree here to get uniform samples and then to find the extreme sources, in this case, the ultraluminous X-ray sources. I'm going to show a couple of examples of Chandra data. This is the bulge of M31 by a paper by Kong et al. The central 17 arc minutes side square. And the data are color coded, as has been said before by Josh and will be in some other figures I will show, where red is the soft energy and blue is the harder energy. And as you can see here, there is quite a rich population of point-like sources, most like X-ray binaries, with some different spectra, seeing the colors. Another example, it's a very recent press release at Chandra, this is M83. And again, same thing, and notice the population of X-ray sources and the range of colors of these sources. X-ray luminosity function. Okay, so what we do is we detect these sources and we look at their luminosity distribution. Now, this is the idea of luminosity function. It's a very old idea, of course, in astronomy. And it gives us a way of probing evolution, formation and evolution of a sample of sources. And in particular, this is true for X-ray binaries. And the following talk by Vicky will, in fact, explore some models in which she creates synthetically luminosity functions that can be compared with the data. Now, the luminosity function, even these first early examples show that different populations of X-ray sources that may be correlated with different stellar populations have different luminosity functions. And this is M81, and the bulge here has a steeper power law with a truncation of the low luminosity, in this case in the 10 to the 37 Hz per second range, and the disk follows a straight power law out to in the range 10 to the 39 Hz per second range. The X-ray luminosity function of bulges, as I showed you in M31, have breaks that are also seen in M81 and M31, where here is from a paper by Kong et al. And it shows, if you look at this part of the diagram, three regions of M31, the inner bulge is R1, R2 is a kind of outer bulge, and R3 is the rest of the galaxy, where you can see this broken power law with a break that marches in towards lower luminosity in the 10 to the 36 x per second in the inner bulge. Now, this could be very important information because it might be related, for example, to the aging of the stellar population. And however, I want to make sure that we all know that we have to be careful when we do X-ray luminosity functions, especially when we look at the fainter sources, because there may be incompleteness effects, and they were mentioned in the talks earlier, that we have to correct for. And just a little digression, this is a case in which a break was there and then it's gone away. It's NGC 1316, which is an elliptical galaxy, nothing to do with the science content of my talk. But these are the Chandra sources on the optical image. And when we mostly work by Dong Woo Kim, calculated the luminosity function, the first time we plotted the data is this empty squares. And we saw the luminosity function with a typical break in the 10 to the 38 Hz per second range has been published in some of the early papers by Sarazin and co-workers, which would be a very nice place to have a break because it's the Eddington limit. However, when we went back and after very extensive simulations, we corrected for incompleteness, what we find is that this luminosity function, in fact, is an uninterrupted power law down to the 10 to 37 Hz per second range. And these corrections are two effects that one has to take into account. They both affect the detection of faint sources. One is the background. The higher background, the less efficient is your detection, and you have to correct for that. And the other one is the beam bias, the fact that in Chandra, I might not be aware of, the beam is very, it's great, it's sub arc second, 0.3 arc second at the end point, but away from the center, it degrades fairly rapidly to a few arc seconds at other radii of the field. So that means that a point source that can be detected easily in the center of the field may be missed a larger radii. So you have to correct for these effects, and the way of doing this is really to simulate your observations over and over and see how well you do at different count rates. And that's what we did. And I invite anybody who wants to do luminosity function to really take this into account before you publish your data. So what are the physical drivers or the astrophysical drivers of luminosity function? Well, one clearly is in star-forming galaxies, the star formation activity or star formation rate. More active star formation, as for example we see in the antennae in M82, by comparison with, say, for example, the disk of M81, results in more and more luminous X-ray binary. So we have a higher normalization, but you also extend to higher luminosities of each individual source. This is the ULX range. And by comparison, here is a steeper luminosity function, which would be typical of bulges, or in this case, is an elliptical galaxy. I think it was published by the Sarrazin collaboration. If star formation is not important, for example, in bulge and elliptical galaxies, then the galaxy mass or stellar content is the driver, and that's not surprising. If you have more stars, you get more X-ray binaries. That explains the different in normalization between small system here and a large system over there. Here also shows the difference in slopes of the luminosity function. Star-forming galaxies tend to have flatter slopes than, so more high luminosity, intrinsically high luminosity X-ray sources, which must be young sources, than bulges or elliptical galaxies, older stellar systems. The link between star formation and the X-ray source production is not new news. It's been known for a while. It was seen for the first time in the Einstein data. This is, in fact, an Einstein plot, where we find that in late-type galaxies from SC to irregulars in the sample, the X-ray luminosity and the far-infrared luminosities are really tightly correlated. And this clearly suggested that the X-ray sources in these galaxies must belong to the star-forming populations, probably high-mass X-ray binaries. Now, more recently, and Andrew King showed this a bit in his presentation, this theme is being looked at a bit more carefully by Grimm, Gilfanov, and Sunyaev, who produced, this is a recent paper in which they show that here we have a series of X-ray luminosity function that they collected for star-forming galaxies like the antennae, I've showed you it already, M82, and including also the star-forming part of the Milky Way, the high-mass binaries, and the small Magellanic clouds. And these luminosity functions, they can all be renormalized by their star-formation rate of the galaxy, and this is what you get. It's what they claim is a universal star-forming galaxy luminosity function with a slope 0.6, the cumulative function, that where you don't see any difference between lower luminosity systems and up to the 10 to the 40 ULX systems. Now, Of course, this type of exercise has some uncertainties that one should look at very carefully, because the definition of the star formation rates and which indicators one uses observationally to measure the star formation rate, it's a problem. You can get different values for a given galaxy, quite a spread of values. But I think this, nonetheless, it's an interesting result. And that brings me to the second part of my talk, which is a few words about the ULXs. Now, my definition of ULXs here is the observer definition. Andrew has pushed the limit up to 10 to the 40 now. Traditionally, actually, when we started talking about what we used to call super-Eddington sources, and that was quite a long time ago, I think Leon van Speybroek was probably one of the first person to spot them in the Einstein data and to call them super-Eddington sources. We were talking of sources of luminosities about 2, 3, 10 to the 38 x per second, more than the internal limit of a neutron star. Now, you know, most people in observers in X-ray astronomy would call anything above 10 to the 39 x per second a ULX. And that means that these are sources that have Eddington luminosities, which, if you take them, you know, in terms of spherical emission, would be greater than what you would expect from stellar mass black holes. So, are these sources X-ray binaries? And I think most of them clearly are. A few of them are young supernovae, supernova remnants, but most of them vary, and they have spectral variability, which is typical of X-ray binaries. I'm going to show a couple of figures. And if they are accreting binaries, what is the accretor? And as you heard before, there's the hypothesis of the intermediate mass black hole, and this would be hundreds to thousands of solar mass black holes. Or the beamed options, the one suggested by Andrew, which would be a moderate beamed emission due to very high accretion rates in kind of normal black hole binaries, or relativistically beamed microquasars, which has also been suggested for some of these sources. And I'm going to review some of the observational evidence that points to one solution and the others. And basically, I think the punchline of this story here is that it may well be that ULXs, at least by this definition, are a fairly heterogeneous class of sources. There may be a couple of cases in which maybe we have this very massive black hole that everybody wants to discover, but I suspect most of the sources may be these moderately beamed stellar black holes with a few microquasars. Variability. This is an example of variability in this 20 years period, all archival data from Einstein to ASCA, of a source near M81. And given the coverage of the observation, this would cover from 20 years to a few months variability. So long-term variability, they definitely vary. This is a few months variability in the, this someone else showed it, I think Simon showed this in this M82, the center of M82, with the very luminous sources coming and going. And down to a couple of hours variability, this is a recent paper by Lewin Bregman on a source in NGC 5194. It's a ULX, and they claim a binary period, but this is all the data they have, so it could just be a short-term variability. I think the periodicity has to be confirmed, if any, but variability is definitely there. They also vary spectrally. And here is ASCA results of two sources in a spiral galaxy, IC342. Where in two different epochs, these are the two sources, they alternate between a hard power low luminosity state and a higher luminosity softer spectrum. This is the high soft, low hard variability, which, as Tom Macaroni was talking about, could be the Zig X1 type, or it, you know, could be a very high state comptonite.
What's the spectral index?
I can't remember, but it probably was pretty normal, 1.6, 0.8, something like that.
Drops from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 5 over 1
order. Yeah. And here is another example. It's more recent. This is the source of the nucleus of M33 that for a while people were thinking of kind of a black hole, nuclear black hole in M33. Now we know that there is no such a thing. And also the X-ray data for this source, they point more to an X-ray binary type object with very high LX in the 10 to the 39 X per second. And again, it varies. This is Chandra data. And the spectral can be fit with two components, a power law and a disk component with different ratio and different luminosity states. A few words about the spectra. And some of this has already been discussed. Now, if we believe that the sources are intermediate mass black holes, as comes out from the luminosity in the simple Eddington calculation, they would have soft spectra. And this is based on, you know, the equations that the previous talk showed, and you know it's a well-known fact. Makishima and his group looked at a bunch of these sources and with ASCA, and they found for all of them that the spectra, the ASCA spectra, could be fitted constantly with a hot disk with a temperature of 1.5 kV, which is definitely much warmer than you would expect from a, say, few hundred solar mass black hole. And they suggested that maybe this was a symptom of a rotating black hole, so the disk could extend in closer to the hole. However, at least in one case, this source here, we have much recent data with XMM that John Miller is a postdoc at CFA, formerly student of Walter here, has looked at from the Chandra, from the XMM archive, and for this source he's found that what looked like 1.5 kV single disk spectrum in ASCA, when you looked at that at with XMM, which means much better signal to noise, requires a two-component spectrum. These are the residuals to the fit to a single power law, single disk, and this is disk plus power law model, and this is the unfolded X-ray spectrum and the two components. And when you do this, the soft component is indeed very soft. It's 100 electron volts, and it might imply a 1,000 solar mass black hole. Of course, if you talk to Andrew, I'm sure he can find a way to make this work in terms of a beam system. So it's not a proof, but it's suggesting indeed. These very soft components are not necessarily always there. We have, at least in the antenna, where we cannot really do yet, but maybe we will by the end of the year, individual spectra of the ULXs with very good signal to noise. This paper by Andrea Zessas and collaborators, we co-added all the ULXs, meaning the source, 10 sources above 10 to the 39 X per second, and we find that the composite spectrum, it's typical microquasar spectrum with 1.2 kV black disk plus a fairly steep flat 1.4, 1.5 gamma power law. So there is quite a bit of range there. Another way what we can try to understand what we're dealing with is to look at the environment at different wavelengths. What's around the disputative black holes? What's around the ULX? Can we identify it with something in the optical, in the radio? And there are a few cases in which ionized nebulae have been found around ULXs. And these ionized nebulae are there in the ULXs NGC 1313, the Joe Miller paper with a soft spectral component. And also there is an expanding molecular cloud that has been reported around the M82 ULX. So now the presence of this nebulae suggests kind of isotropic emission. If this is the case, maybe it is true that these sources are really massive objects. But this is not always the case, because there have been identifications, and these are in two galaxies, 5204 and M81, papers in the literature where with HST blue counterparts pointing to a high mass binary have been identified in the Chandra boxes. Another fact comes from comparison between Chandra and, in this case, HST data, is that in the antennae we find that the UL axis, so this is a fairly complicated picture, so if you're interested, if you really go look at the paper, but the punchline is that if we look in the Chandra error boxes of the UL axis, we do not find a stellar cluster, although there is a stellar cluster in the vicinity, and we typically find an average 2 arc second discrepancy in position between the Chandra source and the stellar cluster, and this is not a systematic thing, it's all over the place, so we don't really think it's a problem in registration of the images. So if this is the case, this may suggest that we have runaway binaries, in which case probably they're not very massive systems, although as we heard before, even black holes can be kicked out, as Simon was talking about, out of clusters. So. And finally, this picture is just a Chandra image of SS433, which I put here to show an example of a beam in an X-ray binary, is not the source we're talking about here. But there is a case very recently reported of radio emission, a radio source coincident with one of these UL axes, paper by Carrot and collaborator. And in this case, the spectral energy distribution from the radio to the X-rays, it's very well consistent with the hypothesis of relativistic beaming. So we may have at least one case of UL axis where we have a microquasars, and otherwise maybe a couple of cases where it would be interesting to see if there are at least candidates for the intermediate mass black hole hypothesis. And most of the sources, they're probably more normal binaries. And I'll say a couple more words about that based on very recent Chandra data. We're doing now, we just finished, and we're analyzing the data, a very deep, almost a half million seconds, monitoring of the antennae done in pieces. This is the original observations 2 years ago, and then December 2001, this is April and June of 2002, and we have, I think, three more data sets coming. And the punchline is that there is a lot of variability of sources at any luminosity level. Of the 9 UL axes that were identified in the December 1999 observations, 7 vary. And one of those that doesn't vary is the nucleus of the southern galaxy, so probably something else altogether. So I would, and we also discovered a variable, super soft ULX, and I will show a few more data. Okay, of the historical 9 ULXs, these all have hard spectra, and they're identified here in the December 99 image of the antennae by these circles. You can see very clearly this is the nucleus, but otherwise they're fairly isolated sources and luminous. And this, here are the light curves, and you can see bumps, you can see dips. I think this is the nucleus, the steady source, and you can see kind of secular diminution sources that go down in luminosity. So you see cases in which a source goes below the detection horizon and then comes back again. We did color diagrams in X-rays of these sources. To see if this type of variability in luminosities could be correlated with spectral variability. And we find indeed that it is the case in 5 sources for which we have pretty good signal to noise, at least to do this type of work. And in one case, we find that this is source 37, which is here. When the luminosity goes down, the source becomes harder, and this kind of the SIGX1 type behavior, but we find also 4 sources with the opposite behavior. They're harder when they're when the luminosities are high, and they're softer at low luminosity. This type of second behavior has also been seen in some galactic sources as well. So where are these sources? This is work done in collaboration with a bunch of people that were involved in the observation. François Schweizer is in the room. Andrew has left, but is responsible for quite a bit of the ideas here. Possibility, I mean, they look like binaries, and they look like normal X-ray binaries, and the luminosity suggests them may be beamed. The high soft, low hard source looks like a SIGX-1, could be one of those. Could also be an anomalous high state black hole binaries with a comptonized disk. The high hard, low soft sources could be black hole binaries with very high accretion rates, maybe like microquasars in some situations. So high accretion rates would increase the temperature of the accretion disk, and that's why we see this kind of fluctuations. Super soft source. One of the sources, doing this work, we found one source that turned up as a pretty hefty ULX later on in our monitoring, but it wasn't there. I mean, it was there as a source, it wasn't there as a ULX in the original observation. And this source, it's also different from all the others by having a really, really soft spectrum. All the photons are below 1 keV. The light curve, just the count rate, increases. And if we take into account the spectral properties, the luminosities in the luminosity in the last observation, since the source is a bit absorbed, turns out to be great, near 10 to the 4 EX per second. It's pretty impressive. Here is the spectrum, data and models, and these are the results for each observation for a black body model. And the temperatures are basically all in the range between, it's 100 keV, I mean, 90 to, EV, sorry, between 90 and 110 EV, something like that. And so that's result. What do we learn from this? Well, one possibility is that we're dealing with the 200 solar mass or more black hole, because the temperature is indeed what you would expect for that type of beast. However, the variability in this case makes this solution a bit implausible, because the radius of the emitting region in the black body would vary by a factor of 10, which is kind of hard to interpret if we think of accretion risk around a black hole. So another possibility that we toyed with, and for a while Andrew was really puzzled by this, is the fact that the radius is 10 to the 9 centimeters, which is the white dwarf radius. So do we have a nuclear burning source, like in a super soft source? But in this case, the beaming factor should be really rather extreme. And another possibility that was also mentioned yesterday would be that this source might be analogous to the one discovered in M101 by Mukai and collaborator, and may be due to photospheric emission from outflow, kind of Eddington-driven outflow from a stellar mass black hole. Okay, so what's next? Dickey's talk is next, which will compare the X-ray luminosity function with the population synthesis models. And then I think in terms of work, well, we need to go and do a bit more of this identification work and characterization of the X-ray sources as much as we can do with HST and ground-based telescopes. And what we learned from the antennae, that deep observations and monitoring observations are really great, and we really should need to do this for more and more galaxies, because this way we can really get the luminosity function down to the X-ray binary, the Milky Way type level of luminosities, which we're familiar with, and we also can study the variability and spectral variability patterns of these sources. Okay.
Yes, I would like to comment on the issue of the super Eddington luminosities.
Right.
First, GS-1915, the ULX in our own galaxy, radiates at a luminosity that's between 2 and 4 times Eddington.
Right.
And depending on the mass and the helium abundance. But there we know that it's not beamed at us, because you see the jets.
Right.
So beaming is unlikely to be important in that case, so the luminosity is really super Eddington.
So maybe the Eddington limit, as we know, it's not a strong limit? Or
no, that's my second point. I mean, you didn't mention the point made by Mitch Riegelmann, who argued that you have a photon instability in a magnetically confined accretion disk, and that you could easily get up to Eddington limit, luminosities 10 times Eddington.
Right.
And I think we don't understand these processes well enough to get really worried up to 10 times Eddington.
Okay, I had a few comments. First of all, I'm not sure, when you were talking about an analogy to Cygnus X1 with a low hard and a high soft state, you were talking about something around 10 to the 39 ergs per second, is that correct?
Yeah, the luminosity range is different.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, so I think that's a misleading analogy.
Anomalous high state.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that's a misleading analogy.
Yeah.
Secondly, I have some problems with fitting black body plus power law models and then really interpreting the numbers as meaning anything.
Mm-hmm.
There's a classic example where this kind of modeling was done for GRS-1915 plus 105, and the inferred inner disk radius was 4 kilometers, which is well below the Schwarzschild radius for a 14 solar mass black hole. So you have to be very careful about interpreting those kind of spectral fits. You can have a little more confidence when you do a confidentization fit, and John Miller did a confidentization fit also and came out with a similar result, so maybe that's a little bit more there. And then the third thing is that from what we do know about beaming factors in microquasars, it seems like there isn't very strong beaming. There's a paper by Gallo, Fender, and Pooley, which suggests that at least for the low hard state systems, the beaming factors have to be less than beta of about 0.4, which has a hard time producing the substantially super Eddington luminosities we see. You may have a better case for beaming in the transient radio episodes, and Eric Kolkers might have more to say about that if he wants to, I don't know. He's on a paper with Rob Fender where they showed that there's a bigger spread in the radio to X-ray correlations in the transient episodes than in the low hard state persistent episodes.
Okay.
Yeah, I was really interested in your discussion about the sources that look as though they might have escaped from clusters.
Mm.
Can you estimate what the velocities are?
It would be consistent, given the age of the cluster, that's in that paper, something like between 100 and 200 kilometers per second, I think it was. It's normal runaway velocities, but, you know.
Just going to comment on the distance to the antennae. Often, distance of around 22 megaparsecs is used. From the tip of the red giant branch in one of the tidal dwarf galaxies, Saviani and I find a distance of about 12 megaparsecs. This may make a difference on the luminosities.
Right, it would.
it will make a difference.
It will make a difference. The distance that we used here was 19 megaparsecs.
Yeah. So
probably we'll lose some of this ULXs. But, you know, the one that was at 10 to the 4 now will be.
On the other hand, I like to have intermediate mass black holes. So,
you do.
You know, I have to either choose between my distance and the black holes. But.
Well, I don't believe that there are intermediate mass black holes, at least in the antennae. There are too many of them, right? And the luminosity function follows very nicely from the more normal XRB luminosity function. So.
Well, we'll try and get our, we'll make sure that we get you a copy of the result as soon as it's accepted.
So you started by showing this result from Grimm et al. About the ability to scale the luminosity function with star formation.
Right.
So what I was a little bit surprised is that, to me, a punchline from that, which you didn't talk about, is that in the Magellanic Clouds, where we actually know what these sources are, many of those bright sources are high-mass X-ray binaries containing highly magnetic neutron stars, X-ray pulsars, which can easily get up to 10 to the 39. So why is it you don't talk about those at all for any of what you've done?
That's
very surprising.
No, that's definitely within the envelope of what's possible. And in fact, it's something that Grimm and collaborators discuss. I mean, to get to the 10 to the 39, it's not that difficult. I mean, low metallicities would do it. We see it in the Magellanic Clouds.
I guess I'm trying to say is your presentation doesn't even mention it. So is there some reason to just dismiss it as a possibility? Or
what the sources I was focusing on here are definitely above the 10 to the 39. So from 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 40. Can we get up to those luminosities?
Well, let me ask a different question. It would be interesting to see, it would be really interesting to see what you can say about 10 to the 39 erg per second sources and whether their spectra are like high-mass X-ray pulsars. That to me seems to be it. You've got a lot more of those than you have at 10 to the 40.
Right.
So it would be interesting to know whether those actually even make sense. So can you comment on the spectral signatures?
Well, the terms of the spectral signatures, they seem to be less hard, at least based on the first observation, that's all we have analyzed so far. They seem to be less hard than the above 10 to the 39 source per second. The sources above 10 to the 9 source per second can all be fitted with a power law. Individual fits are all with power laws that tend to be about 1.4 or so forth, also in the quadrant spectrum plus a soft component.
But that's the funny thing, right? That's also true in the LMC and SMC, right?
The
very bright
X-ray pulsars are soft sources. They like microquasar spectrum. I mean, they don't look very peculiar. I think I'll be able to tell you more in a few months when we analyze the entire data set, because we should have better statistics. And that would be a really interesting thing to look at.
More questions? Okay. Let's thank Pepe again.